You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
Thinking about the politics of transforming our society is hard work. What is our vision of a new society? What's our strategy for getting there? Simple and necessary questions to pose, but answering them is far from easy, and not everyone's up to trying. Chris Spanos is committed to posing these questions and exploring a variety of answers. And to this end, he's contributed to and edited a new book on this subject. The book is titled Real Utopia, Participatory Society for the 21st Century. Chris is familiar to Red Eye listeners as a former member of the collective, and he remains an enthusiastic supporter of Co-op Radio. Chris now works as a staff member of ZNet in the Boston area of the US. And hi, Chris, it's great to see you back in the studio.
Hi, Peter, it's great to be back here in the studio with you.
Now, Real Utopia, that's the title of your book. Why did you choose such a paradoxical title?
Well, it on the one hand, it's in the tradition of left utopian thinking. But first, we wanted to propose something that was practical, that did not exceed human capacities in the real world. Something rooted, we wanted something that we believe was rooted in real world conditions, in history, that was not made for angels on earth or something, that didn't assume moral purity for people, something that they could really work with. Something that is, in fact, a product of people's struggles.
So something realistic, then? Something that offers realistic opportunities?
Absolutely. And the word utopia is derived from the Greek, meaning nowhere. So in that sense, we wanted to offer something that was something that could be in the future, that was transformative of the defining features of society, that propose new social and material relations, but again, that real people in the real world could deal with, not something divorced from reality.
So you identify vision and strategy as the two central elements of the book. Why are they so important?
Well, vision inspires us. The question that we grapple with in the book, and the reason for proposing this vision, is how do we change the world in this century? So, and what does it look like? And looking back at last century's experiments, we have the opportunity to look at how things may have not gone the way that we would have liked them to, and what were great disappointments, and then look into the future and see how things could possibly be. So the vision, we place heavy emphasis on vision, and that's very much needed, I think, today, because if you compare what's wrong with the world, how much we work on saying what's wrong with the world and spelling it out, we have piles of books going up and, to the roof, whereas if we have, compare our analysis about what's right or what we hope to win, there's very little of that. So we wanted to place heavy emphasis on that. How we get from here to there, the strategy part, is also something that leftists this century have, if they've even begun to grapple with the question at all, it needs to happen much more. And last century, people were grappling with strategy. They were grappling with program to realize a new world. This century, not so much. And we need to reopen that debate.
So then you develop your vision in the framework of what you refer to as participatory economics, or par econ, and that's how it's often referred to. Can you give us some idea of the origin and perspective of this particular vision?
Sure. The participatory economic model is just a vision for the economy. The book as a whole has vision for other aspects of social life. So participatory economics deals with material life and the production, consumption, and allocation of of goods for consumption and production. And basically, it's a reorganization of the workplace. It's a reorganization of the allocation system. It proposes new divisions of labor in the workplace. It proposes that we have a new way to look at work, which is both based on desirable and undesirable work in the workplace, and that we can combine these tasks within the workplace for an equitable distribution. So in a workplace today, you have a corporate hierarchy, people who don't wrote work and people who do conceptual work. And we propose a reorganization of this. In the economy, there's a democratic planning model that replaces markets. And workers' councils and consumer councils that are self-managed get together and they negotiate the production plan. But that's just an economic vision. The rest of the book deals with a vision for the other side of life as well.
Now, is this one of the visions that came out of social movements in the 60s? What's its roots?
It comes out of left tradition throughout all of history, trying to bring out the best of these traditions in the thinking and the theorizing. And specifically, ideas around class come from, or inspired by ideas from Barbara Ehrenreich. She had this conception of a professional managerial class to reorganize work so that everybody had a division of labor between mental and manual work to create whole people and to reconceptualize life along these lines, economic life. So this model adopts that and also kind of expands on that class analysis. And also takes experiments from left history, Yugoslavia and markets, and tries to see what went wrong with that and why, and why we might want to reject markets and embody some forms of democratic planning. It looks at Kerala, India. There's examples of that in the book. There's a whole chapter on village-level public good planning and Porto Alegre and these kinds of things, and tries to elaborate on that and present this model. So that's where it comes from generally.
One of the proponents of that model that I've definitely heard about in the past is Michael Albert. And in the second section of your book, you have that's titled Revolutionizing Everyday Life. There's a spirited and sometimes humorous exchange between Barbara Ehrenreich, who you've just mentioned, and Michael Albert, with their different takes on whether, you know, on the core idea of ongoing participation in decisions around everyday life, whether it's attractive or not. Is Barbara Ehrenreich there just playing devil's advocate to Michael Albert's enthusiasm for participation, or what's going on there? You tell me.
I think she genuinely believes that democratic planning in all areas of the economy would be overdoing it, per se. And I think she genuinely believes that markets need to take care of certain aspects of society. Like Michael, I agree with his analysis that markets are kind of like cyanide in a public water supply, where one drop just spreads and contaminates the rest of society. And they have a very lively discussion and debate about this, and I think it's a very healthy discussion in the book, because she represents ideas and reservations about the model that many people have. And even though I find Michael's arguments convincing, I still think that she has resistance to them. And for me, I believe people have decision-making capacities and skills that could enable this kind of economy. I don't think she's in any way arguing against that people have these capacities or skills. She just thinks it'd be more practical. But we think it's very dangerous to have markets. So.
Fascinating. Yeah. I think these are discussions that go on in movements all the time, sure, that are based on exactly that sort of dichotomy there, or false dichotomy to some extent, that sort of graded scale. So now capitalism's in a steadily deepening crisis at the moment. The US has elected a president who's evoked an emotion of hope among Americans. What opportunity do these two new developments provide to advance your vision and strategy for a new society?
Well, I think it's important to recognize this crisis in you know, I'm not an economist, so I can't cite statistics on how many jobs are lost or how many homes are lost or how it's affecting the Canadian economy or the global economy. But anybody who's paying attention knows that thousands of jobs are being lost. There's been an ongoing food crisis for some time. In the U.S., thousands of homes are being lost, mortgages per month, and that this is a serious crisis. But I think the real crisis is not this crisis that we're experiencing now, per se. It's the everyday structural crisis of capitalism that has existed before this current symptom of capitalism, as severe as it is, and it will occur even after regulatory reforms take place. And it's also the case in the election of Obama, where we have a structural crisis. It is a class crisis. You can walk outside the streets of Vancouver right down here around Co-op Radio. You can any major street in any city, and you can see people essentially coming apart at the seams. And we have a political crisis where people may make decisions. I mean, Obama was recently awarded one of the best advertising campaigns in 2008, outbeating Apple. And this was a campaign that tried to inform people why they should make some kind of rational decision for and making a rational choice, an informed decision to make a rational choice, when in fact the campaign and the marketing made people make an uninformed choice for an irrational decision, meaning Obama didn't present anything. He didn't offer really anything. And his administration is looking like it's lining up to be some of the same old faces who were, in fact, cause for many of the economic crises that we're having. The political crisis is one where people perceive a quadrennial electoral extravaganza once every 4 years coming out to vote, and then that's their voting capacity, that's their decision-making capacity. But we don't have decision-making capacities in our society that people are taught and how to not only affect the choices in their workplaces, but also in broader society. And we have a cultural crisis where U.S. culture, is in mainstream culture is in many ways being exported around the world. It's having negative effects. There's all kinds of crises, but there are structural crises, I think. And this vision, I think, can bring our attention to the underlying structural roots of the crises that we're experiencing and allow us to work on campaigns to get from here to there that address those structural roots rather than the symptomatic things we may be experiencing.
Do you get any inspiration from some of the movements that have happened recently in Latin America?
Absolutely. I think what's happening in Venezuela is very interesting. Obviously not perfect, but when you see things like communal councils and the ability for people to try to engage, to have more control around the things that affect their lives through these councils, that is very inspiring. And that's something that is not having to do with markets or something. That's something where if we were to compare what's happening in the U.S. and Venezuela, we could learn a lot from what's happening in Venezuela or other experiments. But the economic crisis right now in the U.S., I don't think people are going to be able to somehow see through that. It's going to take a lot of work for us to be able to point attention towards Venezuela and other experiments.
Thanks very much for joining me to talk about it.
Thanks very much, Peter.
My guest has been Chris Banos. He's a staff member of ZNet in Boston. His new book is called Real Utopia, Participatory Society for the 21st Century, and it's published by AK Press. There will be copies available at the book launch. That's tomorrow at Rhizome Cafe, 5:30 p.m., and that's 317 East Broadway.